atheist friends and my non-Christian friends, they assume that, oh, well, you were influenced by the culture. You were influenced by progressive thought or liberal friends or whatever, and that's why you changed. And I say, no, I changed when I was deeply immersed in conservative culture. No, I changed because I got deeper into scripture. I got deeper into the Christian tradition. I changed as I started studying the words of Jesus, the testament, the interpretations of Anabaptist thinkers and Franciscan thinkers and people that, and Catholic worker type folks, and started realizing it was Christianity was the thing that changed me. It was not this outside narrative. It was the testimony of the Christian tradition.
It's probably more complicated than that.
Hi, and welcome to The Heartburn. This is Doug Harrison. So if there is any single word that has been important to me in putting together this podcast and why we're here, it's been the word precarity. You know, the one related to precarious. Because I live my life wedged between some very interesting communities and some weird convictions, and people notice it, and it leads to a lot of really good conversations, ones that tend to be really, really important. And that's been the context for me to work out things like my spirituality, like my faith, or my sense of vocation, or even my relationships, my friendships, the people I love. Everyone I know who seems to work through the strangeness of their own lives well does it because there's something that drives them. It's their passion. Something makes their heart burn, and it's usually something to do with love. To be perfectly honest, most of us live with some precarity. You live with some precarity, and that matters to me, and I want to provide you with everything that I possibly can to work that out and to find out what you love, what makes your heart burn, and what helps you to love well. So that's where we start. A simple word, precarity. If there's any word that's important to our guest, Dr. Mike Clausen, it is transformation. It's part of his own story, which he'll share with us. But first, can we do something just a little bit weird and take a few minutes and talk about recent church history? Now, I want to be clear. This is not a Christian podcast, and not every or even most episodes are going to be related to like Christian stuff. But I want to talk about this because we've been talking about it. The church is having an identity crisis, and in a lot of ways, it impacts most of us for a lot of really different reasons. Dr. Mike Clausen has some insight into this, and he's going to help us. He has a PhD in church history from Biola University. He is the founder of the Spiritual Transformation Project at spiritualtransformationproject.com, and I have worked with him on the New Story Festival. You can find out about it at newstoryfestival.com, and we'll talk about it some here. But he'll start by talking about this little phenomenon we call the emerging church. So stick around, listen to his story, and then show up for us at theheartburn.net. Please drop by because you can find out more about the podcast, but you can also leave a voice message and respond and share your thoughts and share your expectations for future episodes. It's a great place to communicate with us and be part of an actual conversation. Also find us on Twitter at theheartburn, and please, please, please subscribe to us. You can always change your mind in the future. And write a review. It helps us so much to stay in circulation and connect with other people and to keep going. Subscribe, review, and visit us at theheartburn.net. Thank you very much. It's helpful. Most of all, what I want you to know is I'm really glad you're here. This is important to me, to have this conversation, to talk about the hard stuff, and to do it with love. That hard but loving conversation starts now. I'm Doug Harrison. Welcome to The Heartburn.
What is emerging church and why does it matter?
It's maybe better to say what was the emerging church, because it was a movement mostly among evangelicals, conservative Protestant Christians, but not exclusively. I mean, it, mainline, more progressive or liberal type churches participated as well. And it was a movement from about the mid-90s till about 2010, 2015 or so, of these people asking questions, rethinking aspects of their faith, of their practice, of their polity, of spirituality, of doctrine, theology. I mean, it was, and the unique thing about the emerging church is that while earlier movements often focus on one or two pieces that they're trying to change, folks in this emerging church conversation really were questioning everything. I mean, they were just putting everything on the table for re-examination, which meant they made a lot of people angry, you know, when you start questioning people's sacred cows and the things that are...
Yeah.
And there was a lot of disagreement. It wasn't a unified movement. There's because different people had different emphases. Some people thought, no, the thing we really need to be talking about is the theology. Other people said, no, the thing we really need to be talking about is the institution or this piece or that piece or politics or and social involvement or whatever. So it was... But it was just this conversation among people that knew something was wrong, something needed to change. They weren't, and they were having a conversation about what exactly. So it's born out of a discontent, a dis-ease, and a desire for things to be better.
So I've been around not just the church, but in some academic circles, some seminaries, ministry in general for a few decades, and I remember sort of residual Jesus people movement, Calvary Chapel coming and going and became a denomination. Vineyard had, and there was the praise and worship movement. There was the seeker sensitive. Mm-hmm. And so each of these had, they often were unified, especially in the case where it may have been like in seeker sensitive is very much attached to Willow Creek, this one
right.
church. And for those who don't know what those movements are, it's fine just to know that there seems to have been several movements over the past decades that come and go. Is emerging church, to what extent is emerging church just another moment like this? Or is it, and is it really about dismantling? Is that its main focus then?
That's a perfect question because that's actually exactly what I wrote my dissertation on. I PhD in history of religion from Baylor, and I wrote about those movements.
Context.
A lot of ones you named started in the 60s and 70s, gained steam in the 80s, and they're really the precursors of this emerging church movement. And so the emerging church, the way I conceptualize it, is that it's a coalescence, a coming together of these different streams of reform, of change, of questioning, and they're both drawing from and learning from and pulling from these movements that happened a generation prior, you know, 20, 30 years prior. And they're reacting against them too. It's both deconstructive, but also reconstructive. They're not just oppositional. So the Jesus people movement, which is basically Jesus hippies, but that's misleading because they're not progressive. They're not, you know, they're adopting, Jesus hippies adopted the hair and the lifestyle and the clothing, but they were conservative, fundamentalist, often Pentecostal Christians
right.
for the most part. But they produced a lot of change in churches that were stuck in one way of doing things. And so a lot of the megachurch leaders were Jesus hippies back in the day. You know, Bill Hybels, who started Willow Creek, he was basically a Jesus freak, part of this Jesus movement. Same with a lot of the other leaders. That's where they get their start. And the same is true of some of the emerging church folks too. Brian McLaren attended kind of a Jesus people movement coffee shop type theology discussion group, Bible study, when he was a teenager growing up in the D.C. area. Same with Spencer Burke, who's another major leader in the emerging church movement. Some of the older figures that were teens in the 60s and 70s, that's their roots. Another stream is also, there's sort of a progressive evangelicalism that emerged in the 1970s, people like Jim Wallis and Tony Campolo and Ron Sider the Chicago Declaration. This is a statement, I believe, in 73, 74, where they said, we need to have, evangelicals should care about the poor and about the oppressed. And these political, social concerns that had been sort of shed by evangelicals when they, I mean, this is further back. I don't want to get too much into history lesson, but evangelicals shed a lot of these concerns and ignored them or said they weren't as important as evangelism. So there was a movement in that generation to reclaim some of that as well. And so you get these influencers in that progressive evangelical movement. You get the influencers in the Jesus people and then the megachurch movement. And they're coming together then in the 90s with sort of Gen X, next generation folks. Again, both borrowing from but reacting to those earlier movements.
Yeah, and so if you'll allow me just sort of a phase of cynicism, if not just skepticism. I've got a couple questions from different angles. One, isn't it the movements themselves are part of what have caused an evolution of the church that's become so distasteful that it needs dismantling? So, I mean, isn't it that that we, and I think it was Bart, this I'm horribly misquoting this quote that goes around seminaries all the time, that whatever church marries the culture of that time becomes a widow in the next generation. That just feels a little bit like the story. And if there's anything to American Christianity, it's like, if all else fails, split and start a denomination. And isn't that just us repeating the same pattern, expecting different results? To what extent?
Absolutely. All of that is entirely true. And I don't want to come across as too much of an apologist. I'm really just observing and describing what I see. Although I was a participant in this movement too, so full disclosure.
Yes.
I do have kind of an insider perspective on it. And there were definite flaws, short-sightedness, things about the emerging church movement. I mean, a lot of hubris, a lot of young 20 and 30 somethings thinking they knew, you know, they had all the answers, or at least that they knew better than their elders. So there's points of critique. And yet I would also say, on the points that you're raising, that's exactly what they were. They would have said the same thing, and they would have said, "Yeah, that is the problem. That's what we're. That's why we're, experiencing this discontent and this disease, and that's why we're questioning and trying to rethink. Is because we feel like the church has become too married to modern culture, to the structures and assumptions of modernity, and it wasn't so much. And this was the common critique. Well, you're just adapting yourselves to postmodern culture. And that's there is truth to that. But there's also a sense with which postmodern thought, deconstructive thought, was just the tool that gave people permission to recognize the ways that the church had gotten caught up in destructive patterns of modern culture, and then begin to understand what that's about and dismantle it and begin to imagine together, well, what could we do differently?
I'm resonating with some of this because there's part of me that has experienced when I've gone to churches that have sort of identified or obviously been influenced by emerging church thinkers or the movement itself somehow, there's often sort of a radical shift into new forms. Mm-hmm. So instead of a sermon, there's a painting station and a prayer station, and this is, you know, completely an innovation. This is new in the tradition. But at the same time, there seemed to be a longing for icons, even candles, contemplative spaces. Like there was a part of the ancient that was missing. So how important is like there a retrieval in the emerging church? Or is it really wanting to innovate?
No, it's not all about innovation. You're absolutely right. There is this sense of reaching back. That one of the key texts, one of the key leaders, thinkers in the movement in the early stages was a guy named Robert Weber, who was a professor actually at my alma mater, undergraduate alma mater, Wheaton College. And Bob Weber wrote this book, Ancient Future Faith. And then he had a few more, Ancient Future Worship, Ancient Future Evangelism. But this idea of ancient future was there are riches from the past that we've lost. It's not sufficient just to try to go backwards and redo the 16th century or the 4th century or whatever wherever you think the church was at its most ideal. And yet we've shed too much and we need to reclaim some of it. And what you have going on with the emerging church specifically is a lot of evangelicals from low church traditions. And by low church, I mean non-liturgical, earlier traditions that had shed some of those ancient forms of faith and practices. And so I grew up evangelical Baptist. We didn't do liturgy. We didn't do those forms, and we didn't do icons. We didn't do ritual. I mean,
if we can suss this out a little bit. So low church is very helpful. I think also sometimes called free church. And I think this is what a lot of listeners will imagine when you see a lot of the churches that are on TV, most of the mega churches, and it's going to be some singing, socializing, sermon.
And sermon and a sing-along.
Yeah. And then that is in opposition to, and the history with that, the less contemporary history would be Mennonites, early Baptists?
Wesleyans, yeah.
Okay. So that is in contrast to what would be called the higher churches. That would be the communions like the Anglican Communion, Episcopal churches, Catholic Church, Orthodox churches, yeah. that have stuck to some longer standing versions of right. Christian liturgy. And so that's or what people might call smells and bells. Even though there are some free church ways of doing those liturgies, yeah. that's it for us, for caricature's sake,
right.
high church is going to be Catholic with incense. Free church or low church is going to be, yeah. that's where the hippie sing-along fits a lot better because...
Yeah, and those churches, the low church, the Baptist churches, the whatever, they have their own, you know, any you can reject ritual and the way things are done, and then the new thing you come up with ends up becoming the new ritual right, and the right. new mm-hmm. sacred cow. And so when the hippies come along, when the Jesus freaks come along, they shake things up by saying it doesn't even have to be a sermon and a sing-along. We can, we can do things differently from that, and we can build mega churches where we have coffee shops in the foyer, and we take the cross and we take the symbolism out entirely, and it looks like a big amphitheater. There was low church, high church. It's kind of a false distinction. It's not just anti-ritual versus ritual. It's certain kinds of ritual. And mm-hmm. so what Weber and others were saying is, let's reclaim some of what was lost. There was richness there that we need to get back to. And this is why. You end up with emerging church post-evangelicals coming to mainline churches that never lost some of that and saying, can you teach us? Can we borrow some of this from you? Can we learn how to do this? And then folks on the mainline side saying, this isn't a rediscovery and this isn't the silver bullet. This isn't going to solve all your problems either because we've been doing this the whole time and we're still declining. We still got our problems.
So when you look at the seeker-sensitive movement, it really was about church growth. It was about seekers and getting people into church seats. It's a little more difficult to sort of put your finger on what emerging church is. And so when I go to in Austin, if I go to this church that's new and contemporary and maybe influenced by emerging church, there may be two or three of them. And if I go to each church, I may get wildly different churches, not just yeah. because of their denomination, but one church, like one could be critical to say that, we feel like we should go to church, but we also like martinis. And so you might get a hipster church.
Yeah.
And you might get one that's married to modern culture or postmodern culture, even though it's trying to share some of these critiques. So
yeah, this is trying to define this emerging church thing is really, it's nailing Jell-O to the wall because it was not one thing. It really was this amorphous conversation of people. And this is how I define it in my dissertation. I call it a movement, but not in the sense of a unified set of goals and ideals and things that they're trying to accomplish. In fact, they really resisted that language. They said, we're not a movement. We're not an institution. We're not trying to create some new denomination that thinks we know how to do it right. It really was a conversation. So I borrow the term a community of discourse. And communities of discourse actually comes from literary theory. A community of discourse is just a community of people that care about the same things and have conversations around a similar set of topics. They think certain topics are important, and so and they have a specific vocabulary, they have a specific set of values, they have a shared set of not goals, but just what they think is important. And that's really what it was. And that's why that you have the diversity that you mentioned, is because they're asking the same questions, but they weren't all reaching the same answers. And that was okay. That was the postmodern spirit of it, was that there didn't have to be one right way. It was multiplicity and variety.
So one of the outcomes of this has been, and I want to keep sort of a critical edge in this conversation for a minute, in part because we're also going to, soon we're going to be talking about, and apparently this is over.
No, I was at this thing called the Wild Goose Festival, which is the inspiration for the New Story Festival that I do, and it's a gathering of progressive Christians in North Carolina in a very similar format to the New Story, and I was on a panel discussion with Brian McLaren and Diana Butler Bass, both of whom were leaders and influencers in this emerging church
yes.
movement.
Yep.
And we were answering the question, where did it go? What happened to it? If it's not around anymore, where is it? What happened? And I said, well, I think it went the way of the dinosaur, which is to say that it evolved. and turn into something else. Because if you ask a paleontologist, they're going to tell you the dinosaurs didn't die out. Some of them did, but others of them turned into birds, and we eat them for dinner on a daily basis. You know, when you have chicken, you're having a dinosaur. That's what happened to the dinosaurs. And so what happened to the emerging church? Well, they turned into wild geese. They turned into things like the Wild Goose Festival and the New Story Festival and other things. It's still around. It's just different now because things kept changing. We didn't stop.
But one of the things that seemed to emerge from this scrambling, so in the story that I'm hearing you tell is that there are these people that are part of church communities, and there's, as a certain age group of people come of age, there is a serious concern about these attachments to modern culture. And so there is an effort, a discourse community about doing some dismantling. There's not a single consensus that emerges, but some things change. And that's why you get some very different experiences in it. But one of the things to emerge that has been prominent has been really the appearance of something like a Christian left or progressive voices.
Yeah.
And so one of my questions is, what is that ultimately what this has led us to? And is this also because, there's two questions in here, I suppose. Is this just a reaction to the culture wars that ultimately, by taking perfect shape of the culture wars, the Christian left was inevitably going to evolve at some time?
That is a big piece of the story. Yeah, there is, it's part of the disease and discontent was a reaction to the Christian right and to culture wars. It's very much, insofar as most of the early leaders and a lot of the movement comes out of conservative evangelicalism, that's part of the culture they're reacting against. And that was one of the biggest pieces that emerging church folks were trying to redo. And they rethought it in different ways. Some said, we just need to be less political. Some said, we need to be political in a different way. And then they differed on what way. Some went a more Anabaptist route of saying we need to present an alternative to the culture, an alternative polis, way of being and way of organizing that highlights nonviolence, that highlights community, that highlights sharing and abundance, but not try to leverage power in the political sphere. And others went more the direction of the earlier progressive evangelicals, the Jim Wallis and Tony Campolo. And these are people that are still, that were part of the emerging church movement too. So there's a sense in which it's the reemergence of the progressive evangelical left that had gotten buried in the 80s by a conservative resurgence. So yeah, that's very much a concern, and they went in different directions with how they answered that concern.
I have my sympathies with that Anabaptist bent, and for those who know the names, like Stanley Hauerwas is most well known for that. And I think where that comes to friction for me is, does the emergence of a Christian left, even as my liberal friends sort of are eager to see something like that, does it also just render the church sort of impotent to say something critical now that we've just taken our roles within the culture wars? I mean, are we just now choosing up sides, and now there becomes part of the church opposing the other part of the church? And so here's where this becomes really frightening for me, is how does a 2,000-year-old evolving moral tradition happen to line up perfectly with one platform or the other?
Yeah.
Just, it kind of historically doesn't make much sense. So both sides seem to be sacrificing something of the story to be in that position. Fine. And so people, and this is not to say whatever, but what happens to the voice of feeding the poor is not liberal, it's Christian?
Yeah. Again, I don't want to appear too much of an apologist, but I really do. That is what I'm hearing from folks that might get described as the Christian left. They're saying, we do this because it's Christian values, not because it's Democratic Party platform. There's very little interest in just becoming a mirror image of the Christian right, where we sort of marry ourselves to one party and support them no matter what. And this gets into the fact that there's a lot of ways in which the things folks on the Christian so-called Christian left are saying are too far left for the Democratic Party in a sense of radical calls for justice, for inclusion, for anti-racism, for poverty reduction. I mean, there's ways in which I think there is still a prophetic voice saying we're not liberals, Democrats, you're not going far enough.
It's probably more complicated than that.
We'll be right back. I have good news, everybody. I'm actually going to be giving away a t-shirt, a tote bag, a mug, actually an item of your choice, anywhere from the Heartburn Podcast Collection or from Doug Thy Neighbor, the store on Etsy, where you can go to just at etsy.com/shop/Doug Thy Neighbor. All you have to review, any review that you give, just put in a little bit of information, click a star, and I'm going to be choosing one randomly selected, not based on your review, randomly selected review each week through August and into September, and you'll receive one item, again, either from the Heartburn Podcast Collection or from the Doug Thy Neighbor store. So don't forget to review. That's all you got to do. And then I will click on it and be in touch with you, and we will send those off to the winners, but you have to review to do it.
So my personal story is that I started as a very conservative Republican Rush Limbaugh fan as a teenager, young adult in college, and I evolved into whatever I am today. I don't know how to label myself, but much, if we're using the left-right spectrum, to the left of Bernie Sanders somewhere. And people, and when I talk to people, especially my atheist friends and my non-Christian friends, they assume that, oh, well, you were influenced by the culture. You were influenced by progressive thought or liberal friends or whatever, and that's why you changed. And I say, no, I changed when I was deeply immersed in conservative culture at Whedon College, of all places, which is a very conservative evangelical school. No, what I tell them is, no, I changed because I got deeper into scripture. I got deeper into the Christian tradition. I changed as I started studying the words of Jesus, the testament, the interpretations of Anabaptist thinkers and Franciscan thinkers and people that, and Catholic worker type folks, and started realize it was Christianity was the thing that changed me. It was not this outside narrative. It was the testimony of the Christian tradition.
So here you are, and you're Christian. Yes?
Yeah.
That's how you identify.
On a good day.
On a good day.
Yeah.
But, and the reason, and so I say that as a question, but the reason that that becomes interesting is that if having been somebody who's participated in some extent with this emerging church movement, who has been part, who is at one time a Rush Limbaugh fan, who has experienced transformation because of the Christian narrative, however you encountered that, here you are today, and it is certainly out of fashion to be Christian in comparison to other recent times in North American culture.
Yeah.
So why are you here in this conversation still, and what's compelling to you?
That's a good question. I have a lot of sympathy for people who just say, this isn't worth it, and they leave. Faith, Christianity, institution, whatever, they just, it doesn't seem worth saving. Whether on the right or the left. I mean, I see people that just, they're not, in sociologist lingo, they're not nuns. They're not giving up on religion. They're just done.
Nuns being N-O-N-E-S.
N-O-N-E, yeah.
Like the nuns, the duns, as opposed to nuns who wear a habit.
Right, yes. So N-O-N-E-S.
Southfield. Yes,
you know, so, yeah. The researchers have talked for the last decade or so about the nuns, the people that are just identify as no religion. They're just done with all of it. But there's actually a lot of my friend Josh Packard is a sociologist, and he's written a book about the duns. What Josh found in his research is that the duns are the people that were the most involved, that cared the most about the institution. They didn't they didn't dislike or the church. They didn't hate the church, and they still don't. They just got burned out. They didn't see change happening in the ways that they wanted it to change. There wasn't an openness to. I mean, they just put all the effort in for very little result, and maybe got burned by dysfunctional systems or bad leaders or whatever.
And so they just stopped going to church instead of stomping away angrily.
Yeah.
Just stayed in bed.
Just faded away. Yeah.
Okay.
So I have a lot of, what I'm trying to say is I have a lot of sympathy for that reaction, whether the duns or the nuns, to just wash your hands of it and say, I've done what I can and I'm done with this, with trying. I never got to that place because for me, there was always hope of change and transformation. Maybe because my evolution was slower and more gradual. It took me 20 years to get to where I am now. And it was one piece at a time, and there was never a sense of sudden trauma or a need to just step away entirely. It was always just, well, I can fix this piece now. I can fix this piece now. I can work on this. And so I call myself a cynic, a hopeful cynic. I look at the problems and and they're real. I'm not going to ignore them, but I've seen change happen in my life. I've changed. I've seen other people change. I've seen communities grow and evolve and become better. And so it is possible. And I never quite got to the point of losing hope that change could happen.
Yeah. One of the deep commitments that I just have as a person, and part of the reason that we're even having this podcast, is that I tend to live with people who have a lot of very different stories from each other in terms of where they ended up. And here, or as part of this podcast, me as a person will always respect that wherever a person is spiritually, it is for reasons, and it is to be respected. So I appreciate you also just honoring it. Look, so as we talk about these things critically, this is not to be dismissive of people who are part of the Christian right, who are people who are duns, nuns, spiritual but not religious. We're just trying to understand the complexity because I think, and what I'm hearing again in just talking here, is that the story is a little more complicated than we painted it. There's more going on here than the church became bad and people hang on or they don't is too
absolutely
facile.
And I absolutely want to affirm I'm not critiquing. Like I said, I have deep compassion and empathy for the folks that are just done or none or whatever. And I have a lot of sympathy for folks on the religious right too, because I remember what it was like to care about the things they care about, and I know what that's about for them. And even though I just have a lot of disagreements now, I still understand that they're not bad people. They're people that care about the things that they think are important. And that's what I want to say is that there's a danger in this cultural moment right now of polarizing, of a lack of empathy, a lack of compassion, a lack of understanding. I'm both on all sides. Right. And so one of my biggest critiques of the Christian left, if we're going to keep calling it that, or folks that, you know, are in that end of the spectrum, is that we start demonizing and vilifying, you know, the Trump supporters and the folks on the other side, as it were, quote unquote. Because I think that's not going to get us anywhere. For me, if Christianity has anything that's distinctive, that's sets it apart from most other philosophies and most other ways of viewing the world, it's Jesus' words to love your enemies in a nonviolent way, to not hate those that are other or different or even hurting and oppressing you, but to somehow transform the suffering and the negative energy that you're getting from your enemies into compassion for them that can somehow lead to transformation.
I find it really compelling to hear Mike talk about the call to love not just neighbors, far more than just friends, which to me seems hard enough, but to love your enemies is an invitation to something much better than I could do on my own. We'll be right back.
You have experienced that change, and even as you speak, and these are very helpful, insightful thoughts to me, and you clearly, you seem to have a connection to it. How is the things that you're saying now translate into how you live today?
The way I do that is by organizing events. I am the co-founder of a festival called the New Story Festival.
Right.
That tries to bring together people across difference from different communities that don't often rub shoulders, but share similar values.
Tell us more about that, because I think that it answers my question in a very full, rich way. So when I say, how is this playing itself out? One of the answers is the New Story Festival, which, full disclosure, I participated in last year. But what did you intend for it to be? What was it in practice? And why does this matter to you so much that you're willing to
get into it? I'm not cut out to do front lines ministry, front lines working with the hurting and suffering. And so what I want to do is I want to bring people together that are doing that work and amplify their voices, support them in what they're doing, share and showcase the good work that's happening. That's the work that I can do. So I build a stage and then try to put other people on it. Whose voices I want to amplify. I'm a cishet white male.
Cisgendered. Heterosexual white male, and to some extent Christian.
Right. So I have all the privilege.
Right, yeah.
And it's not that those voices, there aren't people in those categories that aren't worth being heard. A lot of my mentors and teachers are that as well. And yet I also want to create a space and a context where other voices, people who aren't that, can also be heard, because their voices need to be heard. And so that's a big part of my passion, is to bringing in the marginalized voices and the folks that aren't usually heard, creating a context where the people who haven't been hearing them are also there.
So is this a liberal version of a Christian festival? Is this going to be a Christian experience, or is this not going to be that? Is it?
We were very deliberate about not wanting it to be a Christian-owned space or an exclusively Christian space. So we call it an interspiritual festival. Any tradition or none at all are welcome to come and share authentically who they are. I don't like the term. I don't like the term interfaith that much, just because it reminds me of priests and rabbis in a room in the 1950s talking lowest common denominator agreements. Yeah. The things we can all agree on and water down are distinctives. That's not fair to my interfaith friends. So I'm not saying that's the reality of it, but that's my connotations. What we were trying to do is say, come and be fully who you are. Bring the uniqueness of your tradition, of your practice, of whatever it is that you want to bring. And just invite people to experience it if they want to. You don't have to be so yes, there was Christians at the New Story Festival, and they were being fully Christian and bringing what they had to share. There was Jewish folks coming and bringing what they had to share. There was Buddhists. There was people who are spiritual but not religious.
All out atheists would have reason to come to this.
Oh yeah, I mean the faith and spirituality and religious parts of it are just one piece. This is not. There are tons of sessions that had nothing to do with that. And there's music, and there's fun, and there's. I don't want to make this sound like it's just come and listen to a bunch of people talk. It's like you said, you can experience spiritual direction, you can participate in creating art, you can dance to the music on the stage, or sing along at some of the sing along events. It was a diverse, just mishmash, hodgepodge, beautiful mess of people coming together, sharing the goodness that they had and that they were already a part of with each other.
And tell me about the name.
So the New Story, people get confused all the time. I always have to explain, this is not a storytelling festival. there was storytelling there, which makes it even more confusing. But New Story, we mean the deep cultural narratives, the underlying narratives of our lives that shape our identities and our sense of who we are and where our place in the world and what makes us valuable. The deep social narratives, the cultural narratives that underlie our systemic. I was talking to a friend yesterday, and he was saying, you know, there's kind of the personal level, there's this social or systemic level, but there's a level beneath that even of these subterranean narratives and stories. So stories of domination, to be safe and prosperous, we have to oppress the people that might harm us. Stories of victimization. We've always been the ones that have been oppressed and harmed. Stories of isolation, of the only way to be safe and prosperous is just to separate ourselves from everyone else. Or a story of purification, of the only way to be safe and prosperous is to get rid of those that might harm us, to cast them out from our midst. We've seen this play over and over again in history. And so we're trying to say there's a better story, a new story, one of liberation, one of compassion, one of collective liberation. None of us are free until all of us are free, including the oppressors, including those that are doing harm. Because at the end of the day, we all do harm at some point or another.
And it strikes me that this being, so this is you having a background as an evangelical, coming through your own transformational process. This is your particular expression of what's needed now. One might say it in terms, this is what God would have you do now. It makes me wonder, based on some of the earlier questions we were asking, if the Christians following the radical Jesus tradition don't appear prominent in the media because at this moment in time, the Christian thing to do is to step back and to make space for other voices is the right thing to do. And that maybe a morally formed Christian at this time is less interested in protecting a Christian space to say, we're Christian liberals, here we're doing, but to say, how about I stop that and just make space for my trans friends to be able to say something, or people of color to be able to have this space instead, and I protect it for them.
That's absolutely, exactly right. And or at least I agree.
For this conversation and for the people who are listening, they've heard all this in your commitments. And again, I think it's already complicated the story to hear that you've tried to put together this beautiful little new story festival. And people can find more information about that at newstoryfestival.com.
Right.
And they can find more about your other work at spiritualtransformationproject.com.
That's also right.
So that tells us a lot about you, and it's complex already. But when it comes to the nuts and bolts, so what does it mean for your spirituality to have a relationship with God? So it's less about theology here, but more about who is God to you and what's happening there now.
Yeah. Well, I want to start with a G.K. Chesterton quote. From his book Orthodoxy. He's a British author, turn of the 20th century, and journalist and writer. And he said, I tried my hardest to create a heresy of my own, and when I put the finishing touches on it, I discovered it was orthodoxy. And that's always been my problem in terms of...
That's lovely.
I would love to give up on Christianity and say I don't view God that way or the Bible that way or Jesus that way anymore, and yet there's this richness and depth of the Christian tradition where there's still room for me. And every time I think that I'm stepping outside of it, I discover that, no, that was part of it too. And so for me, it's just, I keep the label because it's truth in advertising.
And would you actually repeat that quote? Because I think our listeners would. And is this from Orthodoxy?
It's from his book
Orthodoxy.
So this
is G.K. Chesterton from his book Orthodoxy. If you would.
He says, I tried my hardest to create a heresy of my own, and when I put the finishing touches on it, I discovered it was orthodoxy. And I mean, that's right. I mean, you know, so my view of God is that I can't have a view of God, that anytime I create an idea of what I think God is, I've created an idol. I've created, a construct in my head that, because it's in my head, a limited, finite brain, it can't encapsulate whatever the wholeness of divine reality, of total reality is. And so, and then I discovered, well, that Aquinas was saying that in the 12th century,
Thomas Aquinas,
the Catholic theologian. He was saying the same thing, that we only can ever talk about God by way of analogy. We can never get our heads fully around it. We can only, as my friend Brian McLaren says, get our heads into it, or hope to. I mean, my view of God is that God is whatever emerges from the sum total of all that is, the thing that's...
Say that again, please.
Whatever emerges from the sum total of all that is, and without getting too much into the weeds of philosophy or theology, there's a thing called emergence theory, which just says that there's higher order systems and more complex systems emerge out of lower, less complex systems, but they don't exclude... The higher order systems are never... are not reducible to, but neither are they separable from the lower order, which is a way of saying that if God is whatever exists beyond the totality of reality that we can comprehend or even glimpse, all of reality is included within that. That it's within God, and yet God is also more than and other than and bigger than, in a way that we can only begin to point to and talk about by way of analogy. The technical term for this is panentheism. It's a, it's not, God is just the same as the universe, and it's not God stands separate apart from the universe, but that in some way the universe, all of reality, our existence exists within God, within this more complex reality that, now your question was a practical one, so I want to get away from the abstract philosophy of this. For me, the implications of that is that it's a question of, well, then what do I think reality is like? What do I think that larger reality, do I think it's just matter and electrons and things like ethics and values and love and connection are just figments of our imagination? Or is there some sense in which those things, the things that at the end of the day matter the most to us, are actually real, like actually part of the warp and woof of reality, of the universe, of existence as we know it? And for me, that's a leap of faith, but I'm going to say yes. I'm going to say that whatever God is, whatever the totality of reality is, it includes things like compassion and value and love for others and connection to others. And it's that's hard for me. That is a leap of faith for me to believe that. Because I'm a hopeful cynic, and sometimes the cynicism takes over.
I love emergent theory, and it always draws me to the, in my mind, any conversation I have about emergent theory also has an image of the starlings. Are those the ones that, or the birds that all fly so fast together and turn, and we still don't quite understand. And those flocks are just so stunningly beautiful.
I want to be clear. Emergence theory is like a legit scientific theory.
Yes, we use it absolutely.
To explain a lot of, we use it to build software. We use it to understand cities and anthills and starlings. I mean, yeah, this is not just abstract philosophy. This is stuff that has real practical implications in our world today.
With some I mean, why ants seem to know what to do without having to go to school. I mean, so there's a lot of, to me, there's a lot of beauty in it, and that the image of the starlings moving and us not understanding how they move in concert is part of, I think, what's beautiful. But you said something like, I know I'm going sort of through the abstract and I want to get to the practical, but it seems to me that for people of faith, that in this era, at this time, I'm looking back even at my own Nazarene church that I grew up in, and it seems that there is a group of people who have walked away and said, ridiculous. There's a group of people, and I'm going to be unfair, and I'm open to the criticism, so people, you can comment on this, but it seems to me some people have sort of stuck their head in the sand. They have kids, and they go, oh my God, we have to go to church. So they kind of just tape their mouths shut, and they sit through it, so their kids have Sunday school and youth group, and you just kind of go with the flow. And my group of friends, even the ones that sat here in my house on Sunday, we call ourselves on a time to time the Nazbins, that nearly all of us have some academic connection. If not academic, we've had relationships with people that are academic. In other words, theology has saved our place in the Christian faith. So it's been a rigorous intellectual process, which has its ironies for the way that we talk about Christianity today, does it not? I mean, so...
I mean, that's my story, too, is that I think, as I said a little bit ago, it was, for me, it was never... There was never a bad thing that happened that made me angry at God or made me question or rethink. It was an intellectual journey. It was questions that needed answered. And I had... I mean, the credit, to credit my parents, to credit the conservative evangelical tradition that I grew up in, they did actually encourage me to pursue questions. And they thought they were going to lead me to a certain set of answers, and they didn't. But they were supportive of that searching after God and searching after the truth and faith seeking understanding, as people at my alma mater like to say, which is a quote from Anselm, another medieval Catholic theologian. And it did. It saved my faith because it brought the abstractions of theology into my personal life, and it made it relevant and real.
That seems important. So you going on this intellectual journey brought those abstractions into your personal life. Is that how you said that now?
Yeah.
So that is, can we call, there's two things I am observing. One, so is theology not just a matter of getting at answers, but a discipline itself, a spiritual discipline?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's a discipline because the discipline is in the intellectual honesty, the personal honesty of not just going along with what you're told or what seems to be, you know, what you're supposed to think or believe, but to really sit with the uncomfortable questions. It's really akin to mindfulness practices of really being present with what is and not ignoring it and not ignoring the heart, the questions that need answers, and then pursuing them and doing your best to figure out the things that are truly important. Because I see a lot of people and that, I don't want this to sound insulting, that maybe just don't have the courage, or there seems to be too much at stake to really do that, to have that sort of intellectual honesty. And so they, as you said, hide their heads in the sand or ignore that nagging voice.
And again, with our both of our interests in empathy for that, what we can say is there are reasons that people get to the question and then derail. Sometimes that's for safety's sake.
Yes.
So as a person who grew up gay, I'm lucky that that never put me at risk of being kicked out of my house or beat by my parents. But for a lot of people that the Christian church, there were safety issues involved. And so to derail was a matter of survival. God bless them. Well done. And there's other reasons that people get to a point where the questioning stops.
Yeah.
But even if that does, there's still the opportunity now to come back to whatever question is there and to engage the discipline.
Right.
What I'm appreciating is my experience, that as we're talking, we can refer to Thomas Aquinas, Anselm. I even was in my mind thinking of apophatic theology in the Eastern tradition. And G.K. Chesterton, and this, again, going back, Teresa of Avila, Catherine of Siena, Macrina the Great, and even things like emergence theories, so that there is a great dialogue of some of the most brilliant living theologians working out conversations with science. So that when these questions come, for me, it's hard to come up to a theological question that hasn't already been asked in some way.
Right.
And so for that to be a reason for one of the reasons for people to derail from the discourse, and I'm not saying everybody who just stays in the game will stay Christian, but to leave the discourse solely because they come across a question that seems to be difficult or doesn't have a quick answer, that's actually good news, because it's there. There's a discourse or a conversation happening somewhere, but the discipline is to stay engaged with it somehow.
Right.
It doesn't always grant, I'm not saying that grants the exact same results for everybody, but that's not the point. But here's, and this is important, all of this, and fun and enlightening, but it's also very difficult to imagine, how do I pray to a God, a panentheistic God, and how can I imagine that God loves me if God is something above starlings and ants?
So I want to take back something I said earlier. Or qualify it, it's not just a leap of faith for me. One of the things that emergence theory does for me is to say, listen, things like love, things like compassion and connection, these exist at lower levels of complexity. We already know these things exist within the universe. There was a Descartes' error, as it was, Rene Descartes, the 17th century philosopher, I think, therefore I am, that guy. He tried to divide reality into mental things and physical things. And we sort of operated with that dualism for the last 400 years or more. And so we start to think that mental things like love and compassion and meaning and purpose, that these are somehow less real than electrons and matter and energy and quarks and leptons and all of that. And it's not. It's also part of what emerges. Consciousness is part of what emerges from the totality of reality. And if it emerges on our level, on our human level, which is just like somewhere in the middle, if you're thinking of it in terms of like nested circles, which is kind of how I think about it, then why wouldn't we think that it exists on the higher levels as well, and that there is something like consciousness and something like mind and something like love and compassion on that whatever God is level. And so when I pray, it's with a belief and a hope that the things that I, that are important to me, like love and compassion, do connect in some way to something outside and bigger than just myself, and that God, whatever God is love, as the Christian tradition says, that God is compassionate. Loving kindness is the Jewish term, the term from the Hebrew scriptures. And there's something fundamental about reality that includes loving kindness.
I want to ask an impossible question, which is, when you pray, whatever that means to you, what happens in you, or what is it that you become?
That's a good question. I actually haven't thought about this a lot recently, of what prayer means to me. It's not... sometimes it looks like what it used to look like, just talking to God as if God were a person, because I don't think God isn't a person. Like, it's not like personhood, identity. Again, this exists on our human level. And so God might be more than that. But it's not less than that. God's not less than a person. And so I do sometimes.
So it's that God might be more than personhood, but certainly isn't less than.
Yeah, I'm not just praying to an old man in the sky. I'm trying not to have that image in my head of there's some, you know, person out there. And yet I'm not trying to have that. I think that's okay to talk to God, to just have a conversation to whatever, to the universe, to God, and say, this is what's present for me. But that's the other thing that it looks like for me, is it really looks like what a lot of my friends call mindfulness, or noticing. That these days when I pray, it's about stopping for a minute and noticing what's going on inside me and what's going on around me, and trying to say, where is God in this? Where do I see God already here? Where do I see divine beauty and energy and love already around me? And so another way of putting that, it just looks like listening and looking for God. I think that's maybe what Mother Teresa meant when someone asked her, well, how do you pray? And she said, well, I mostly just listen to God. And they said, well, what does God say then? And she said, well, he mostly just listens too. And that's what it looks like for me.
Mike has certainly been on a journey, and he's made that journey in part through intellectual discipline, through friendships, through his own act of service. And for him, it is in a place of listening, noticing, and paying attention to the patterns of greater emergence. He's also in a place of privilege and gifted at organizing, so your journey might end up being very different. But what seems possible for everyone is some kind of transformation to be more of who whatever it is you are called and made to be as you understand it. I wonder what your journey will look like. That is the end of our episode for today, but it's just the beginning of listening to The Heartburn. Up next, we're going to have a wonderful conversation with, full disclosure, one of my besties, Melissa Tucker, who's going to talk about being a woman in her position, helping middle-class Americans experience and discover and rethink and re-love immigrants in a new way. It is fantastic. And not long after that, I have an amazing interview with Sarah Capostasi, who's the Director of Services at Out Youth in Austin, Texas. I just want you to be a part of it. It's one of the best ways you can make sure this keeps going. Please subscribe. Please review. I will say it until I'm blue in the face, which is very short time from now. But I really want you to be a part of this. Also, leave us a message at theheartburn.net. This is about the conversation, which means it's about us. It's about you. So meet me here. My name is Doug Harrison, and this is The Heartburn.